introduce Creighton, but before I do that, I want to tell you a little story about Mike and his family in Creighton. I think it was 3, 4, 5 months ago, Mike came over and said, "Do you have any tapes?" And I said, "Yeah, I have tapes." I gave him 3 tapes, one of which was Creighton's. And 2 or 3 days later, Mike jumped on a plane with both of his parents and flew out to Oklahoma for a trip to see some grandparents and sisters and things like that. And during this trip, Mike plugged in Creighton's tape. And his father said, "Oh, my God, is that who I think it is?" Turns out that Mike's dad and Creighton were in flight training 40 years ago together. So, no coincidences, huh? I met Creighton about 5 years ago. He came to town to share his experience and strength and hope with us at the intergroup dinner June that the central office always has. And fell in love with his story at that point. He was, I was affected by it. But I also loved his humor. And for whatever reason, Susie and I were asked to take them back to their hotel, so I suggested that we go somewhere for dessert. I guess we got to the Buckhead Diner about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and we were asked to leave at 1:30. Now, we were stone sober, but we had closed the joint down. That period of time, Susie and I were just getting ready to get married, and Creighton and Patty had just been married, putting 2 families together, so there were a lot of wild stories and laughing and that kind of thing. Creighton's the kind of guy he's a little on the tricky side. He does things and doesn't ask for any credit for some strange reason. And I asked Patty to tell me a story before I came up to introduce him to illustrate that. Turns out that when we met them, they were living in the North Carolina mountains. They're now living in the bustling burb of Corinth, Mississippi, wherever the hell that is. I'm going to get him a T-shirt that says, "Where the hell is Corinth?" But evidently Joe Theismann was coming to town to speak to the state football champions and a lot of other people. And Creighton went behind the scenes and got 4 of these kids and had them dress up in shirts and ties and had them sit in that meeting and pretty much told them what it was all about. And, of course, they got to listen, to their hero. And they didn't know it, but their hero is what got them there. And so you're in for a real treat this afternoon. I'm going to bring Creighton up right now.
Two years of pro football makes me walk like I did up to this stage, so I'm glad to be here, still walking. My name is Creighton Pendarvis, and I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't found necessary to take a drink, go to jail, or steal anything over $50 since the 1st of March of 1976. And for that, I'm just real, real grateful this afternoon. This is, as that baseball player said, this is deja vu all over again when I got to meet Mike. And I knew Mike when he was just a gleam in his daddy's eye, long before he was born. It's a true story. Bruce and I went to flight school together a long, 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 long time ago. If it hadn't been for Bruce's dad, I would not have completed that flight school because I'm a hell of a football player, but I'm dumber than dirt when it comes to aerodynamics. And his dad pulled me through a real tough course in aerodynamics. And for that, I will always be grateful. And we never know when our paths are going to cross. First of all, I want to thank Tom for inviting me and the rest of the committee. My wife and I are enjoying the hotel. Air conditioning works fine. Sheets clean. Towels are so fluffy I can hardly close my suitcase when I leave. And I think it's just wonderful to be here and get to see old friends like Smitty last night and Cease and Keith and Cricket. And gosh, we haven't seen each other in so long, and it's just grand to be here. And Bill, wherever Bill D is, and lots of friends. And I want to tell you how grateful I am that you haven't had a nap this afternoon and are sitting here, because the 2 o'clock speaker on Saturday afternoon, hell, that's nap time for drunks, you know. And I'm just real glad that you're here to hear me. I do two things before I ever start a talk, and the first is this. And this was, I was ordered to do this a long, long time ago by my sponsor, and he said, before you ever start an AA talk, I want you to read five things. And we call these the five observations of conference speakers. And it's just real simple. And this is the way it goes. Number one, AA speakers are just plain drunks. No different from you, believe me. Number two, they're not brighter or more sober or more successful or more spiritual. They're just more eager to hear the sound of their own voice. Okay? Number three, AA speakers are not special people. We come in all shapes, sizes, periods of sobriety, and levels of humility, just like you. And number four, use caution when you hear any AA speaker who holds special after-the-session meetings, closed-door sessions for inner-circle spirituality. Because I can guarantee you they're not carrying a message, but they may be spreading a disease. And number five, beware of any AA speaker who uses an inordinate amount of profanity. It's immature, it's inappropriate, it's unacceptable, and it's certainly not part of any AA program we're familiar with. Well, the first time I read those, I sat down. I didn't have anything else to say. You know, that was it. The second thing I read is perhaps the most important thing that I'll ever read in an AA meeting. And for the newcomers, especially for the newcomers, I say this. And it's on page 30 from chapter 3. It's called More About Alcoholism, and it simply says this. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our own drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Here's the kicker. First sentence, second paragraph. We learn that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Well, on March the 1st, 1976, through a series of misunderstandings, a little tough luck, I shook two in a Lady Kenmore box under a bridge in North Kansas City, Missouri. It had not been my intent to get there, nor had it been my plan in life to, when a high school counselor said, well, what are you going to do with your life, Creighton? I said, well, I'm going to end up as drunk and live under a bridge, you know, what the hell? I just got there, just like you did. That day dawned like a day hadn't in my life. Now, where are you going? Can't take it. Yeah, okay. Should have gone before you sat out.
A
Always one or two, isn't there? Yep. But that day dawned like a day hadn't in a long, long time. And what happened was, see if you can identify. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. I was just in that limbo. And that's the worst place for an alcoholic to be in their life, is in that state where you can't get drunk and you can't get sober. It's the most miserable feeling in this world. And that's where I was that morning. But a lucid thought had come to me, and the thought was simply this. I don't want any more of this. I simply want off the treadmill. I want out. And the only way I know to get out of this lifestyle is to take my own life. I wasn't going to, leave notes or call anybody, even if I'd had the telephone. I just wanted out. Well, I was dressed in my wardrobe, had an old pair of marine green wool breeches on, zippers rusted shut, and I had an old pair of yellow tennis shoes. They had originally been white, but they were yellow for the same reason the zippers rusted shut. And I had an old raggedy shirt on, leather and a leather flying jacket, and that was my wardrobe. I was down to it. I had 40 cents to my name. 40 cents to my name. I took that 40. I hadn't had a bath in a long time. Hadn't had a bath in a long time. And I took that 40 cents and I went down to the bus stop there on the corner of North Oak Traffic Way at the base of the ASB Bridge. And I got on that bus, and I could have had any seat on that bus I wanted. And I rode out to this house where I knew a car was parked. And the car belonged to good friends of mine. They had been good friends and would be friends again. And I got on that bus, and I breathed a sigh of relief. And probably for the first time in years and years and years, I was at peace. Perhaps like you've been. Because I had made that decision. Didn't know it at the time. But I had made this decision to take my own life. I rode out to this house. I broke into the garage. Found a vacuum cleaner hose. Put one end in the tailpipe. The other end in the car. Got the keys. Put them in the ignition. Got in. Turned the ignition on and nothing happened. And if you're bent on suicide, you've ruined your whole day right there. But here's what happened. Out of futility, out of the absolute futility that I couldn't even kill myself, I screamed out something to the effect of, God, if there is a God, please, please do something for me because I can't even kill myself. And I cried and cried and cried that release. And I love Chuck Chamberlain. I love to hear him say it when he used to talk about page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, it's all about, and then he'd just yell it out, surrender! And that's what I did. Didn't know it at the time, nor, just like you, nor did you know at the time. But we surrendered. We have to, at some time in our lives, surrender, or we wouldn't be sitting here this afternoon. And I surrendered that day, and I had no more idea that was the last day I'd ever take a drink. I had that, that was the farthest thing from my mind. Because when you're in that kind of condition, you need a drink bad. But I broke into that house, and I made a phone call. Because the next thought that came into my mind, have you thought about AA? And I thought I knew all about AA. In 1950, just like this guy sitting here on the front row that we heard last night. And by the way, if you didn't hear Smitty, for God's sakes, buy the tape. It's the finest talk I've ever heard him make, and I've known him for a long time. But in 1950, my dad, who'd been a bad, bad drunk, and lived in Charlotte, North Carolina. He hocked a vicuna coat and a Crosley radio, and he took his son, me, to the first international conference in Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. And there was only about, probably 14 or 15 of us kids. And I was a pimply-faced, puke, 15-year-old kid. And we went to this international convention, and there is a guy who is very, very controversial on AA, still is. But he took us kids. He took us kids under his wing, he and his wife. His name was Clarence Snyder. And Clarence and Betty took us, and they introduced us to Smitty's dad and to Bill Wilson and Sister Ignatia and Sam Shoemaker and Dr. Harry Tebow and all the big shots and all these people, and took good care of us. And I was so impressed with, I thought that this was the greatest organization in the world, because my dad, who'd been such a bad drunk, all of a sudden loved his son. Hell, he had always loved me. He just didn't know how to show it. But we had the best time on that trip, and I got to know my dad a little better, and I thought AA was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I knew it all had to do with willpower. All had to do with willpower. Because all you folks that have been such bad drunks, and it took willpower to stop drinking. And my dad, back in those days, they made lots of 12-step calls. And we had a basement in our house, and so that's where they'd bring the drunks. And guess what they fed them? Peraldehyde. The old Cleveland and Akron solution. Dr. Bob's solution was sauerkraut and stewed tomatoes, peraldehyde, and Coke syrup for the heaves, for nausea, and Cairo syrup or honey and orange juice. And that's what they fed them, down in the basement. And we only had one door to that basement, so, you know, they were trapped. Once they got down there, there they stayed. And you could hear them shaking and carrying on at night. And I thought to myself, don't miss this. I thought to myself, I'll never, ever, ever, ever drink, because I don't want to be that way. And little did I realize, I didn't have a darn thing to do with it. It was already in the cards for me, for whatever reason. But that's what I thought I knew about AA, willpower. So on that day of March the 1st of 1976, I broke into that house and I picked up the phone, and I had, with old mucousy eyes and a hand that was shaking like a peach orchard borer, I'd looked in that phone book and I found that phone number down there in North Kansas City, and I called them about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, this is before the vogue of noon meetings. Somebody answered that phone. Bob Smitty was talking about coincidences last night. There are none. Somebody answered that phone, and they, of course, the first two things you ask a new drunk, dumbest questions in the world. Number one, are you in trouble? Did you ever know a drinking drunk that would say, oh, yes, I'm in a lot of trouble? No. Series of misunderstandings and a little tough buck, and a lot of people just don't understand me, but I'm all right. And the second dumbest question is, do you have a car, Well, I live under this bridge at the time, and, I didn't want them to think so. I was some Johnny-come-lately, so 15 minutes later, I was driving a stolen car that had started this time to my first AA meeting. And another thought came to me. I wonder if I'm bad enough to have to go to AA, The rest of my wardrobe, hadn't had a bath in a long time, did not have a suit of my name, and off I went. And I walked into that AA hall. It was upstairs above the savings and loan at 1812 and a half North Swift Avenue in North Kansas City, Missouri. The bar was on one side. I knew where that bar was. and the slammer and the police station were on the other side, and I sure as heck knew where that was. But I'd never had any money, so I didn't ever put it in the savings and loan, and I had no idea there was an AA hall above that savings and loan. The story used to be, if you can get upstairs to that AA hall, then after 90 days or so, you're going to have little money to put in the savings and loan. You don't have to go back to the bar, and you sure as heck don't have to go back to jail ever again. I walked up those steps, and the only time I've ever done this in 27 years of continuous sobriety was I knocked on the door, and somebody said, "Come in." And I walked in, and there he was. This guy was standing there, and he had a grin on his face. I mean, he had a grin from ear to ear. And he had that hand stuck out, and I literally had to turn around to see in the world who he was grinning at. Because not many people grinned at Creighton Pendarvis in those days. Not many people smiled at me. But he was. And he stuck that hand of AA out. He stuck your hand out. He stuck the fellowship's hand out. And he says, "Hi, I'm Jack. Welcome." And I stuck an old mucusy, dirty, filthy, shaking hand out. And I said, "I'm Creighton Pendarvis." And he said, "Would you run that name by just one more time, you know?" Listen, that name is half Irish and it's half Greek. And I didn't know how to stay drunk or open a restaurant for years. You know? But I said, with all the modesty that I could muster at that time, this is true story. I said, "You can call me Captain." Because I wanted him to realize immediately that he was dealing with an airline captain. And he could probably tell that I was between trips, you know, just would stop by for a minute. And he looked at me so funny. And he said, "Well, I'll call you Penn." And we sat down there and we started talking about, gosh, I don't know what. But there, the traditions were on one side, big traditions on one side. The steps were on the other side, just like there are in so many AA halls. And I looked up at those steps, and I saw that word, and I turned to Jack, and I said, "Jack, I'm not going to be able to make this." And he says, "Don't worry about that word, God." And I thought, how the heck did he know? But he knew. 8 o'clock came around. And before that, I started shaking pretty bad. And about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was shaking so bad that Jack said those magic words to a drinking drunk. He says, "You look like you need a drink." And I thought, what a deal this is. And Jack went down to his car, and like so many old-timers, and some of us still do, we carry a jug in the trunk of our cars for guys named Creighton. And he brought a jug up, and I took my last drink of alcohol in an AA hall sometime the afternoon of March the 1st of 1976. And I did what every drinking drunk would do, and I smoothed out. And I smoothed out, and I had that little necessary nap, and at 8 o'clock that night, the meeting started. How It Works was read, and I convulsed. Boom, right on the floor. Now, we had a lot of folks in that group that we call golden slippers, in and out, in and out, in and out, you know, back and forth in the program. And these old golden slippers were gathered around this guy flopping on the floor, and they looked like a tree full of owls, you know, watching me flop. And they said, "Ooh, that really does happen, doesn't it? You know, we've heard about this, but we've never seen a live one, you know." And there I was flopping, and I can guarantee it's better to be a watcher than a flopper any time. But old Doc Newton was there that night, and they carried me back in the back room and laid me on a couch. And the members of the North Kansas, don't miss this. Don't miss this. The members of the North Kansas City Alcoholics Anonymous group literally saved my life. Literally saved my life. They went back to the kitchen, and guess what they got? The formaldehyde, the orange juice and the honey, and the Coke syrup, and Doc Newton went down to his car and got a sedative, a hypo of some kind, and gave me a hypo, and they started feeding me that stuff. And I laid on that old couch just like you would have, filthy dirty, and vomited that old green bile in a little tin pan. And the members of the North Kansas City group hung in there and got a wet washcloth and put on my forehead. And they said, "It's going to be okay, Creighton. You're going to be all right." And I thought if I heard that one more time, I'd die just in spite of them. Because you see, my ego was such that I was so embarrassed that I wanted to die. Because you see, I didn't want you to see my red raw meat underneath this facade. Because I didn't want you to realize that I was a bum. You already knew that. You already knew me better than my mother did. Just like I know the faces I'm staring at better than your mama knows you. Because we are just alike. We have different clothes. We have different professions. We have different educations. We have different this and different that. But up here and in our souls, we're exactly, exactly the same. We know each other that well. I know what makes you tick. And I know, and you know what makes me tick. I know what buttons to push on you, and you sure as heck know what buttons to push on me. We know each other that well. And that's the commonality of the disease called alcoholism. And that's why God has, in His omnipotent wisdom, has given us the ability to save lives, to save another drunk. Smitty's dad and Smitty's mom knew exactly how to work with Bill Wilson, the conist of con men. And that's how we got, that's why we're here today, because of those two men. And because of this old geezer sitting right here who I love more than life itself. Because of his dad and his family. And because of this kid sitting right here, whose father is not an alcoholic. But the byproduct of those people right there are sitting here. That's how our paths cross sometimes. You know, the journey. But that day I knew nothing about this. That day I was so full of me. And what it was ego. The ego of embarrassment and fear. That little four-letter word that will kill a lot of us in this room. Fear. Fear of being found out. Fear of being found out that we're phonies. Fear that we are not what we really appear to be. And that day, I wanted to die in spite of myself, but you wouldn't let me. And you literally saved my life. You literally saved my life. And I didn't want you to. Well, the next day dawned, and you decided the captain needed a bath. Boy, I agreed with that. So you took the captain's clothes off and found out the captain didn't wear underwear in those days. My drink of choice had become Aqua Velva, and Aqua Velva and Fruit of the Looms went for about the same price, and guess which one, you know. So you took, this is a true story, you took the clothes down to this wash chair right around the corner, and about an hour and a half later you came back and you said, "We got some good news and some bad news, and now those pants kind of shrunk up in the crotch, you know, you're going to have to work those out a little bit." those old wool britches, but the zipper's unstuck. What a deal that is. You know. And the shoes are white again. They look like Aladdin's. They're kind of curled up on the ends there, but you can work those out. And the shirt just evaporated. We don't know what the hell happened to it, but it's gone. But that's the way I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was ungrateful, and I was phony, but I was clean. And the people loved me back into life. About 3 or 4 weeks later, I'd hung around that club, and I didn't have any place else to go. And I stole my first big book. And if there's any newcomer in here, before you get real honest, steal a big book. You can pay us back later. And about 3 weeks later, I was standing up, I was sitting in the back row where all the, nothing against the people sitting in the back row in this room, but that's where all us newcomers sat. We called it Wino Row back there. And, you know, we don't gossip in AA, but we share because we're very concerned about others. And we were sitting back there and said, well, that looks like an easy score over there, you know, or what about that one, you know. And actually, the best meeting is not right now. The best meeting will be after the meeting, when we get all those in-depth inventories taken, you know, about, well, did you see who she was with? Or did you see who, well, they'll never stay sober. Well, and we were back there, and this old geezer was talking. And this guy was older than Cecil. You know, and he was uglier than Cecil too, you know, and he was standing up there and he had this great big blown up mugshot of himself. He was holding it up when he'd been throwing the slammer out in Hayes, Kansas for a DWI. He was holding it up and he says, like Cecil, he says, now there I am drunk and here I am sober. And again, like Cecil, he's always going to look better drunk than he ever would sober, you know. So he's standing up there, and I'm thinking, God, you know, where do they get these guys, you know? Oh. And the basket was coming around, the collection basket was coming around, and I thought I was more blessed to receive than give in those days. And my hand was in there. And all of a sudden, I feel this guy's arm on my hand, and I look up, and it's this old geezer, and he says, I wouldn't do that if I were you. And I'd been caught. And he says, and by the way, son, I'm your new sponsor. He says, we drew straws for you. I lost. And a guy by the name of Ken Halstead became my sponsor in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. God love Ken Halstead and all like him, because he was one of those sponsors that was a hard-hearted sponsor that had a heart like a marshmallow right in here. And he got me down in that big book, and we started with the appendix, or started the first page, and we went through the big book. And I'd like to tell you that, you know, that I'm a quick study. I'm dumber than dirt. So we would go through that book and go through that book and go through that book. But what was catching on to me was that Ken had the patience of Job. And Ken knew all about me before I'd ever opened my mouth. And Ken became a banker. Now, I'm probably the only one that ever hung a lot of paper in AA. For those of you with little thin blue lips, that means I cashed a lot of hot checks. And so we started in making restitution. And I got a job. And I told Ken, I said, well, you know, I'm, he says, you've been around here for about a month, and you're not working. I said, well, I'm waiting for the airline to call me back. Of course, They'd taken my license away from me for, you know, a year or two before that. He says, well, you need some employment. So I became a China mechanic, dishwasher to some. And I was washing dishes at the Gold Buffet, which was right around the corner from the AA hall. And they'd taken up a collection for me, and I lived at the Ben Bolt Hotel. Anybody ever been to North Kansas City, Missouri? Okay, the Ben Bolt Hotel is clean. It's a clean little flop right up the street. It had a light bulb hanging down from the center of the room, bathroom down the hall, but it had a little cot, change of sheets once a week, clean towel every 3 days, and I think it was $3 or $4 a night. And they'd taken up a collection for me, and all of a sudden it was the nicest bed and it was the nicest place I'd ever had. I'd been down there for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I'm probably the only person in the room that when they were new in AA, they couldn't sleep. You know, and I tossed and I turned and I fidgeted, and it was up and down and all around that room, and I paced and paced and paced and paced. If I'd had a treadmill, I would have walked 150 miles, I know, in that little room all night long. And one night I was so mad at myself because I couldn't go to sleep. And I had to be at work at 5:30 in the morning. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was laying on that little cot, you know, looked like a tree full of owls. And I had the big book that I'd stolen. And all of a sudden I opened it up and it flopped open to page 63. And I read those magical, magical words that told me that I was going to walk a new way. And that I was going to be reborn. And that I was going to say a prayer that would relieve me of the bondage of self. And I fell in love with page 63. And I got one of the most blissful night's sleep I've ever had in my life. And that started me on my journey. Now, did I automatically the next morning get up, walk on water, and glow in the dark and all that? Of course not. Was I a little more honest? I don't know. I don't know. But something happened to me that gave me enough impetus that I knew that I was going, that something had happened to me. Something had happened to me. Well, I was washing dishes at the Gold Buffet, going to meetings, and I had a checking account. And I didn't want a checking account because I didn't want to cash any more hot checks. So Ken went with me to the bank. And we opened this checking account. And then on Friday, he kept the checkbook. He wasn't dumb. He kept the checkbook and he wrote the checks. And I would sign the checks on Friday evening after the meeting. Now, you know, here I am, a big-time international airline pilot. Flew nice people. I was a captain on international flights all over the world. And on Friday evening, I was sitting there with my sponsor signing checks for $10, $15, and $20 and sending to people that I'd written hot checks to. And I was starting my financial amends. And that's the way I started my program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Slowly but surely. About 2 or 3 months into the program, on Saturdays, my duties were to set up the chairs for the Saturday night meeting in a hall about a third this size. And I would mop the floor, and I was setting the chairs up, and Ken came in the afternoon, just the two of us sitting there, and he came up, and Ken was not an affectionate man, but he had his arm up on the back of my chair. And he gave my shoulders a little squeeze, and he said, son, what step do you think you're on? Now, I'm 3 months sober, okay? 3 months sober. And I, without batting an eye, I looked up at the front of the room and looked at those steps, and I said, Ken, I'm having some trouble with number 9. Old man's on the floor. I think, Jesus Christ, he's having a heart attack. laughing himself to death, you know. He gets up and he points that big old bony finger in his chest and the tears are coming out of his eyes. And he says, boy, you're on one. And don't you forget it, you know. And it's times like these that the new member of Alcoholics Anonymous wished to God they had a car so they could crush their sponsors to death in the AA parking lot. Boom, you old goat, you know. That's the way I came into AA. A little bit about me. I'm a Kansas kid. I was born and raised in a little town in Kansas. My grandparents raised me. My grandfather was a doctor. Loved me to pieces, but was one of these fellas that couldn't show it, you know. He was back in those days where you pulled up your own socks, you know, and he was very structured and very stern. My grandmother was just the opposite. She loved me to pieces. Just loved me to pieces. And I asked my grandmother one time, I said, you know, what can I do to make my grandmother or make my grandfather love me? And she said, oh, Creighton, your granddad loves you to pieces. And I said, but he doesn't show it. She says, why don't you make some good grades? Because I didn't make very good grades. So one 9-week period, and I was in the third or fourth grade, I made 5 A's and 1 B. Now, there's a star in the east when Creighton makes 5 A's and 1 B. But I made those 5 A's and 1 B, and at dinner time, we called lunch dinner in those days in farm communities. The evening meal was called supper. And so at dinner time, I came home for lunch and showed my grade card to my grandmother. And she looked at it, and she hugged me to her bosom, and she says, your granddad's going to be so proud of you. And I just bubbled because I knew that my granddad was just going to hug me. And my granddad came home and sat at his place at the table and sat down, picked up my grade card, looked at it, looked at me, and guess what he said? That B needs some improvement. I'd never made a B in my life, let alone an A. And my grandmother gave him a stern look, and I was crushed. But yet, by the same token, that evening, in the second story bedroom window, I heard my grandfather say, and he was out on the driveway talking to the lady that lived next door, a widow, Emma, Emma, Creighton made 5 A's and 1 B, and I'm so proud of him. And I thought to my little 8 or 9 year old self, why in the world couldn't you tell me that? He couldn't tell me that for the same reason I couldn't tell my children that I was so proud of them as they grew up. And you know, since I've been in AA, AA has done so much for me. But one of the biggest things it's done for me is I'm able to tell my children, God, I'm proud of you. God, I love you. I'm so proud. I'm so proud you're my son. I'm so proud you're my daughter. And grandkids, ho, 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 ho. I tell them I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I have you for grandchildren. And I hug them and I kiss them. And you know, I wasn't able to cry for a long time. And now I cry the tears of joy when I see my grandkids. In fact, they open a new Safeway store and I'll go down and cry for them because I'm so happy they're going to be successful, you know. My prostate's bigger than my ego these days, and it's so much easier, you know. It's so much easier for guys that have been around this program to hug each other. And tears of joy come out of rooms like this. Tears that never would be able to shed through the guise of alcoholism. Well, we come into this program and we read this old textbook and we work with others and we're so proud to be associated and watch somebody grow. watch somebody grow in the program. And what a deal that is, you know. What a joy that is. What a gift from God that we get watching another man grow and seeing him go from nothing and seeing them get their families back in some cases, or even get a car, you know. And we become very, very thankful for this. Well, as I told you, in 1950, I went to live with my dad. And I finished high school, and I got a football scholarship. And in order to take advantage of that football scholarship, I had to go to a little junior college up in the mountains of North Carolina to get my grades up. It was called a jock college. And now, where are you going? I'll be back. Okay. Buy the tape because you're going to miss this. And I went to this little jock college, and I met this lady sitting on the front row up here. And she was, she had great big blue eyes and long wavy hair. And boy, she was something else, I'll tell you. The problem was that she was Miss Everything. She was the May Queen and this and that. I was a dumb jock, scared to death of her. And we never went together. And she was engaged to some goof. And so we didn't run in the same circles, you know. But I admired her from afar. My heart went pity-pat. She and I, 40 years later, went to a reunion, and we'd gone off and we'd had lives, separate lives, together. And we met at our 40th reunion, and something happened, and about 6 months after that, we married. And Patty, why don't you stand up? I'd like for people to meet my wife. And that's the Patty of my life. She's something else. I ended up playing football, University of North Carolina, football scholarship. I used to say that I graduated. That's not true. I ran out of eligibility. And the pros picked me up, and I went to the Washington Redskins, and I played some professional football for the Washington Redskins. And back in those days, we made $6,000 a year. That was not much money, but we sure had a heck of a good time. The military draft was coming along, and I was going to be drafted. And I decided that, that I wanted to do other things, and I ended up, make a long story even longer, I ended up taking some tests for cadets. And then on the way to become a flight cadet, I took drunk, and I ended up at Parris Island, South Carolina, as a grunt Marine, and I ended up in the Marine Paratroopers. And finally, I guess they thought I'd learned my lesson, and I got that flight school. And I went to that flight school at Del Rio, Texas, and met Mike's dad with our class, and graduated from that flight school, and got into some awfully heavy drinking. And by this time, I'd met and married a wonderful lady, and I was flying jets, and I was the most responsible person that you'd ever met. Had a wife and a child, a little girl, and I could fly 3 feet off your wing and be the most responsible guy you ever met in your life. At high rates of airspeed, and I'd land that aircraft, raise the canopy on it, and taxi that aircraft in, and with my arms up on the canopy rails and thinking, God, I wonder what the poor people out there are doing, you know. And I'd taxi that airplane in, I'd park it, get down and hang my equipment up, hang my helmet up and my parachute up, and get ready to go home, and then I was scared to death. Why? Hated responsibility of a house, of a home, of a wife. Didn't know how to act. Immaturity. I was 23, 24 years old, growing on 13, maturity-wise. And I just landed an aircraft, a multi-million-dollar aircraft, 3 feet off your wing. Most mature, responsible guy that you'd ever meet. But I had to have a drink in order to get my courage up to go home. Now, there's something wrong with this picture. And I'd go to that bar, and that after that second Everclear martini, I'd look in that back mirror, and all of a sudden a metamorphosis had taken place. And a lot of guys in this room know what I'm talking about. And by the way, if you think if you think denial leaves after 27 years, I still carry a comb. Okay? Dang. And I'd walk into that bar and I'd sit there and that long black wavy hair would come in, you know. I never had long black wavy hair when I had hair. Jesus, I'd give anything for your hair, you know. And I'd look in that back mirror, and all of a sudden those steely eyes, you know, and there's a cleft right here in the chin. And I'd raise that arm, and all of a sudden I was a lover and a killer. And I had 75 cents worth of chili running right down the front of me here. Been impotent for about 6 months and couldn't lick my lips, you know. And I'd dream another dream and fall off another bar stool, and I'd look down at the bar, and I'd see some pretty gal sitting down there, and I'd say, yeah. And they'll leave, you know. But every once in a while, one would go, but been there, haven't you? Yeah. There's a live one up here. All of a sudden, you know, off into a meaningful relationship you'd go. It's a heck of a way to live. And I'd dream another dream and fall off another bar stool. And my kid was having water on her post-toasties because I never had any money. And I'd play Run, Drink, Run, what the alcoholic is famous for, because they hate themselves so bad. You know, in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that line in How It Works talks about we're constitutionally incapable of being honest with ourselves. That line bothered me for years and years and years and years. And I've come to believe this, rightly or wrongly. All that means is that I can't look in the mirror. I can't look in the mirror. Because when I look in the mirror, I see a monster. I see a monster that I hate for whatever reason. And all of a sudden, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able in the last few years to look in the mirror and sometimes, on good days, be able to wink. And that's a big change. That's worth the whole trip right there. To be able to look in the mirror and realize that the monster's gone away. And in its place is somebody that you not only like, but you halfway understand. And bigger and better than that, you accept what you're seeing. And the only way you're able to accept that is by living this program one day at a time to the best of your ability. Some days better than others. Most of the time we're running as fast as we know how to run, doing the best as we know how to do. And that makes us able to look in the mirror and not see the monster. And all of a sudden, something happens, and we're constitutionally capable of being honest with ourselves before we even know it. And that's when we can get honest with other people. And when we become honest with other people, what happens? We like ourselves a heck of a lot better. We're better sponsors. We're better husbands. We're better fathers. We're better mothers. Simply because we've forgiven ourselves and we've asked God in that third step prayer to relieve me of the bondage of self. And the mirror was the bondage of self in many, many, many cases. And take away my difficulties. And my biggest difficulty was forgiving me. Forgiving me for my past transgressions. Once I get past that, I'm able to live a little better life. Well, in those days, I didn't know how to do all that. I didn't know how to do that, all that at all. So I ran overseas. And 6 months after I was, or 6 weeks after I was overseas, I was standing before my commanding officer, and he's not happy with me. We intuitively know. And I was standing a stiff brace, and he looked up at me and he says, "You're a bum." And I thought, the word's out. They know. Because you see, I'd known I'd been a bum for a long time. I just didn't want you to know. And I spent money I didn't have buying drinks for other people that I didn't even like, trying to make you like me. But they'd found out anyway. He said, "You're cashing hot checks, you haven't sent any money home, and your wife's going to divorce you. And if I had the power, I'd kick you out." And all of a sudden, I was brought back to this country, and I was out of the Air Force. But the Marine Corps took me. They needed dummies. And I was back overseas, and this time there's a shooting war going on. And I went out to my fighter one morning, and I was pretty well hungover. In fact, I was so hungover I was in a blackout. And I was going to fly with the best friend I'd ever had in my life that morning, and I crawled up on that aircraft, and I started to get in that cockpit, and I put my helmet up on the glare shield. But I couldn't figure out if I was going out on a mission or coming back from one. I was in a bad place. 20 minutes later or so, we were airborne and high rate of airspeed. And I came out of that blackout. I looked over and Terry was tucked in just exactly where he was supposed to be, as a good wingman should have been. And I'd flown up the wrong valley. And we picked up ran fire, and I turned into my wingman and I killed him. And all of a sudden, the wise man was right. My soul was as black as night. And the windows, our eyes were the windows to the soul. And my soul was as coal black as it could be. And I ended up in those hospitals, and I hated me, and I had to drink. I didn't have a choice. And the two best friends that I'd ever had in my life started sitting on the end of my bed. And one was called guilt, and the other was called remorse. And they'd reach in my gut every morning and say, "Good morning, Creighton," and grab me. And I'd have to have that drink to make them go away. And it worked for a while. Worked for a long time. Because I could make him go away for a while. And I got out of that hospital, and by this time I'd remarried. I told that wife, "I'm going to turn over new leaf number 642. And I meant it. If I'd taken a lie detector test just like you, we would have passed. Because I desperately wanted to believe that I was going to turn over that new leaf. but I didn't know how. And for a while I didn't drink, and we bought the pretty little house in Kansas City, and I went to work for that great airline. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to fit in more than anything. And I wanted to fit in this little neighborhood. So, you know, I was going to build a little white picket fence, got the holes dug for the fence, and then I'd trip over the holes when I mowed the lawn because I was busy and never finished the fence. Drunks are busy people. Busy, busy, busy. And then that day came that, unfortunately, I was sitting naked in my trees. My tree, my yard, you know. I'd fall out of the tree offering you a drink, you know. Want a drink? I'd fall, revealing my shortcomings as I fell out of the tree. And it was unbecoming behavior. And my wife had me committed before she left. And I was in the real estate insane asylum. And my chief pilot came up and he says, "Boy, we got to get you out of here before the newspapers get a hold of this." And they did. And I started flying international. Worn out my welcome in Kansas City. So I left and was flying international all over the world. Easy to explain. Golfers golf. Fishermen fish and drunks drink. That was Hong Kong, Creighton. Great bar. They'll build you a suit while you're sitting in the bar in Hong Kong. How was Johannesburg? Great bar. How was Paris? Super bar. How was Lima, Peru? Bad jail. Great bar. Yeah. All over the world, never got out of a bar. And finally that day came in January of 1974, and I ran an aircraft off of an icy runway and put the main gear in the ditch. I would have done it sober, but they'd been looking for an excuse to get rid of me. I'd been looking for an excuse to get rid of me, and I got fired and got my license taken away from me. And then for 2 years, a lot of things happened to me that are none of your business, as a matter of fact, but suffice it to say that I had gotten in a lot of trouble and I ended up under a bridge in a Lady Kenmore box, dressed in my wardrobe, and I'd lost everything, including my ticket to fly. But the miracle of miracles, we never know what's going to happen to us as we go through this journey. And 3 years into sobriety, that old sponsor of mine in Kansas City said to me, "Boy, I want you to go down to Oklahoma City and talk to the FAA. And I thought, "Ken, you don't know what you're talking about. You know a lot of things, and you're a wise man, and I love you to pieces. But there's just certain things that you don't know about, and the FAA is one of them. And I'm not going down to Oklahoma City, you know. It's called fear is what it is." And so on my way to Oklahoma City, I thought, what am I going to tell these people? And Ken had told me, he says, "When you meet with this doctor at the certificate branch, medical certificate branch, certification branch, I want you to tell him the truth for once in your life." And I walked into the office there, and the secretary looked up and she says, "You must be Creighton Pendarvis." Boy, it scared me to death. You know, I thought, you know, I'm just a little paranoid. And she says, "Doctor, I'll see you in just a minute." And the minute this old geezer comes and he says, "Come on in here, boy." And I went in there and I sat down and he says, "What can I do for you?" And I started telling him all about me. And about 10 minutes into my spiel, he pulls something out of his pocket and flips it up on the desk. And I pick it up and it says, "To thine own self be true." And it had an X and a 5 and 2 1s on it. And Dr. Audie D. had been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 years. I said, "You know Halstead?" And he says, "He was my first sponsor." And I walked out of there with a certificate to fly airplanes that afternoon. And I was back in my profession. Things like that don't happen, do they? Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. And I went on and was able to rejoin the airlines and ended up my career flying airplanes. Actually, and I don't say this in a braggadocious manner. I really don't. Because I had nothing to do with it. But God had everything to do with it. And you people had everything to do with it. Because if it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't know about God. And if it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't know about sobriety. And I wouldn't hear the stories that I've heard in 27 years, the stories of miraculous recoveries. And I wouldn't have gotten to meet this old man right sitting right there, or that old fellow right there, or get to meet a kid whose dad got me through flight school. These things wouldn't have happened. And like Smitty said last night, there's not coincidences. There's just miracles. There's just miracles, you see. 11 years, almost to the day, from the day that I crawled out from underneath that bridge, I was made vice president of Northwest Airlines. Of pilot training. How'd that happen? It happened because I took one step at a time, wanting to take 20, with an ego bigger and arrogance and pomposity that would just, and getting knocked down, two steps forward and one back. And the most important thing was not picking up the first drink. And some days just hanging in there. Some things that have happened to me along the way also of benefits. I had two daughters. After 17 years, I wrote a letter of amend to that one, to my oldest daughter. And I got a letter back that said, "Dear Daddy, I love you." From a daughter I hadn't seen in 17 years. And she says, "I want to see you because, you see, I understand about alcoholism and you're my dad." And we were reunited. And I'd like to tell you that everything was the same. It wasn't. But at least we have a speaking relationship and we respect each other and we love each other. And I don't see her as much as I'd like to because she was adopted by the man that married her mother. And she doesn't bear my name anymore. But she's still my kid. And she's doing well. And she's 40 years old now. And doing super up in Pennsylvania. That second little gal hated my guts. That's putting it mildly. Because you see, I deserted she and her mother also. Just before her mother had me committed to the insane asylum. And she used to send me birthday cards and Christmas cards and call me on Father's Day. "Happy birthday, you GDSOB. Happy Father's Day, you GDSOB. And then her mother called and she said, "Creighton, Tracy's got anorexia and you need to come up and be part of the treatment program in this treatment facility." And I went up there to Spokane, Washington, where she was in 1986, 87. And I came back from that, and I was so full of hate, not at her, but at myself. The monster was back in the mirror. And I went to David, who had become my sponsor, because you see, I'd gotten back with the airline in Dallas, Texas. And I had to have a sponsor, not a long-distance sponsor, but somebody that I could look on one-on-one. His name was David Aronofsky in Dallas, Texas. And Gracie, his ever-loving black belt Al-Anon wife, was there. And I said, "You know, what am I going to do?" And he says, "Talk to Gracie." And it just so happened that a lady by the name of Elsa Chamberlain was in town that weekend. And those two gals took me to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I introduced myself in that Al-Anon meeting as Creighton Pendarvis, an alcoholic, and I still got the scars. Literally, I've got scars on my shin where that old lady kicked me under the table, I mean hard, and says, with those pretty little thin blue lips and those glassy, glassy blue eyes, Elsa Chamberlain says, Creighton, we do not introduce ourselves as alcoholics in this meeting. It's for the Al-Anons. And I've never forgotten that. And I've been an Al-Anon ever since. So I'm a double winner. And what happened was I found out it's a million miles from my head to my heart. And the program of the Al-Anon family group taught me that that daughter didn't really hate me. But she loved me. And she was frustrated because she'd been cheated out, and she had resentments because she had been cheated out of a lifestyle because I had deserted she and her mother. I'd like to tell you that that daughter recovered from anorexia. They had told her she would never have children. I have two wonderful grandchildren. I'd also like to share with you one of the joys and the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the day she married, I walked her down the aisle of a chapel in San Diego, California, one of the beautiful missions. The only problem was she married a Air Force captain. And at the wedding reception, it's, as we all know, it's the ritual that the bride and groom get the first dance. And it just so happened that she came to me and she said, would you have the first dance with me, Dad? And the music was, You're the Wind Beneath My Wings. Only in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous do things like this happen. Only in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous do guys named Creighton Pendarvis, who lived in a box and didn't give two pinches of nothing for anybody except himself, and who hated the monster in the mirror, can ever stand here this afternoon and be part of a program that saves lives. Don't ever doubt that. That saves lives and restores families and gives you another chance and an opportunity to talk to a God that you may not ever, ever, ever have understood before. But look in the faces around you and see the joy and know that there's something besides a nothingness out there that causes these things to happen. And get to meet the guy sitting right here who was there when this whole thing gets started. And then listen to guys like Keith this morning. We'll hear Cease this morning. And for God's sake, stay for Sunday morning and hear this lady right over here. Stories not only of recovery, but of hope and joy. And the fellowship of just feeling good. Rick is from God. Thanks be to you, God, for my life, that I live in a home and not in a box, under a bridge, or in a cell in an institution. And thanks be to you, God, for carrying me to AA's doorstep. And thanks, God, for my children and my grandchildren who love and respect me. And thanks again, God, for allowing me to retire from a wonderful business that I love so much, that of flying. And thanks, God, for my May Queen, who's now my wife and my closest ally. but most of all, God, thanks be to you for never having forgotten my name. Thanks, Marietta Brownup. God bless.